Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The latest census numbers are out, and they show a tough reality for many Americans under 30. Unemployed or stuck in dead-end jobs, staying in school and racking up debt, falling behind the old tempo of life. There are warnings of a lost generation, whatever that means. This hour On Point, young America up against a tough reality and figuring it out. You can join the conversation. Is that you, your kids, 20-something and looking for your way? What are you finding? What are you thinking? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're not here today to point fingers at the young. I'm surrounded by 20-somethings and up-and-coming teens. These are people we care about. We're paying attention. Joining me now in the studio is Andrew Sum. He's an economist and director of the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University. He's been looking at the latest census figures on the young. Andrew Sum, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you. And with us today from Washington is Matthew Siegel. He heads the nonprofit advocacy group for young Americans called Our Time. It's been called the AARP for the under 30 set. Matthew Siegel, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you with us. Andy Sum, first to the numbers. What are the census reports telling us?
Well, Tom, there's actually a series of different stories that have been covered on this topic, but they all are in many respects interrelated. So let me just start with kind of with the labor market side.
Yep, jobs.
Jobs. Because the most important finding here is that if you look at not just the last few years since the Great Recession, but if you look at the whole past decade, what you find is that among 16 to 29-year-olds in the country, their employment rate fell by almost 12 full percentage points, from 67 down to 55%. Now, to put that in perspective, over the same time period, among older adults, 55 and older, the employment rate went up.
And yet,
even though
we've got such unemployment.
Yes, went up for older workers, and it went down tremendously for people under the age of 30. Now, that size of that employment decline, you know, for young adults, it's not only large in an absolute sense, but about a week ago and working on a set of new papers on this, what I had shown was that that employment decline was actually bigger than it was in the Great Depression of the 1930s, just to put that in perspective.
For young Americans?
No, for all Americans.
For all Americans,
The employment rate fell by less than 12 percentage points in the Depression.
Oh, you're saying young Americans have seen a bigger drop now than all Americans saw in the Depression.
That's correct.
The Depression.
That's right. We have never seen anything like this, to be honest with you, since the end of World War II, and in any group affected this badly in the labor market. Now, what happens is around that general story, though, when you break it out, you ask, well, who's doing better than others? Mm-hmm. I mean, is this universal? What you find is men, for example, have been hit a fair amount harder than women.
We're talking young men.
Young men, yes. Mm-hmm. And a large part of that, Tom, has to do with the nature of the job losses over the decade. Blue-collar jobs, particularly in manufacturing, construction, transportation, were hit a lot harder, and men tended to dominate jobs in those industries. Mm-hmm. Education, health services, and health and social services did better. Women tend to dominate employment in those industries. Mm-hmm. So young women fared somewhat better than young men did in this downturn. Every age group, by the way, from 16 to 29, lost jobs at a big rate. However, it is true, the younger you are, the greater were the job losses. So those kids that are 16, 17 years old, we basically threw them out of the labor market.
Is that a big deal? Or, you know, that was sort of a funny money for weekend movies and it doesn't really matter?
There tends to be a serious misunderstanding of that. Mm-hmm. Because basically the work experience that you get when you're a teen and young adult helps them promote your employability, your wages, your earnings when you get in your early to mid-20s. Mm-hmm. And we also find, that's interesting on this, Tom, that basically the more work experience you bring to the job in your early 20s, the more likely it is the employer trains you. When you come to the job without any work experience, employers are unwilling to train you because what if I train you and you leave because you don't know what you want?
Right.
So basically early work experience matters. And again, just to reiterate why I think this is important, it's also when you take a look at the very young, it turns out that the lower your income, the less likely you are that you work. Higher income kids are the ones that work. Low income kids are the ones that don't work.
Well, higher income kids, they're at McDonald's slinging hash?
Absolutely. Until you get to the very top of the income distribution, the likelihood that a teenager works rises with his family income.
Okay.
And then the last two things is again, what you find is the more schooling you have as a young adult, the more likely it is that you're going to get hired. However, among young college grads, we have this other problem, Tom, that we refer to as malemployment. Okay.
Malemployment. As in not good.
Yes. Some people refer to it as overeducated, Tom. Mm-hmm. But basically what it is that a larger share of our young college grads are working in jobs that simply don't require a college degree. The net result of that is your earnings in those jobs is much less than it is if you get a job that requires a college degree.
So they put in the time in school, they put in the money to pay for school, but they're not getting jobs that pay back on that.
That's right.
If they've got a job at all. I mean, I'm looking, Andy, at a number here that says students now finishing their schooling, the class of 2011, this is from a few months ago, are confronting a youth unemployment rate above 17%, almost double the national rate.
That's all. The joblessness rate is also a problem, Tom, don't get me wrong. But what I'm saying is, again, if you rank young adults by their level of schooling, the more schooling I bring with me when I come to labor market, the more likely I get hired. However, among the very top, and that includes associate degrees, bachelor's degrees, and master's degrees, that a larger share of them are working these jobs. And by the way, the job you picked up was, as an example, was not a bad one. It turns out, like among bachelor's degrees, we estimated there are more young bachelor degree holders working as waiters, waitresses, and bartenders than they are in all engineering occupations combined.
Wow. Say that again.
There are more young bachelor's degree holders working as waiters, waitresses, and bartenders than there are in all engineering jobs combined.
Now, think about that, not only for all those individual young people, but for the future of this country, which is also on the table with them almost by definition. Andy Sum, stand by for just a moment here. I want to get Matthew Siegel in. Matthew, I mean, you're out there trying to represent this generation, and you hear that? We've just got the bare skeleton of numbers there, and you already see the depth of the challenge. I assume, Matthew, that this is vividly apparent. You're 25 years old. To your peers, you don't need a census study to tell you this.
You're 100% right. Every young person today is feeling a mixture of anxiety, frustration, desperation, but I think most importantly, determination, because we're uniquely optimistic about the fact that we've completed higher education to such a extensive degree. However, when we leave the higher education system, as Dr. Sum noted, we're becoming waiters and waitresses and bartenders as opposed to professionals in a variety of different fields. And what that does is, of course, not only kill our confidence, but it's kind of a broken promise. Because when we've been promised growing up that if we keep our noses clean, we graduate high school, we work hard, we make good grades, we go to college, we take out the loans even to afford college and put the economic burden on our families to pay for college, and we leave college, and then we leave college only to return back home to live on in our childhood bedroom or in our parents' basements with part-time work or no work. It's incredibly demoralizing, and I think you know, we need to advocate on behalf of this constituency in many ways for that reason.
Back home, sleeping under those sixth-grade soccer trophies, or, you know, I've seen you quoted saying that young people today feel like they've been handed a bag of lies. I think was the colorful phrase you used. But this millennial generation was seen again and again as very optimistic, very sort of determined to change the world, do it their way. Is that gone? Is it there? Is the fire just banked? What do you see, Matthew?
Well, there's kind of an inquisitive component to that, because I think we're uniquely optimistic given the fact that we're so socially connected via technology, the internet, Facebook, all these different social networking sites. And so we feel that we can create change and communicate and get things done to a more rapid degree than ever before.
And yet you can't just whip up a different unemployment rate on Facebook.
You can't. So I said, ironically, within that same socially connected context, where we're also more socially empathetic, where we also have easier access than ever before to information, to employment opportunities, we feel helpless in the sense that there are clearly not enough employment opportunities to go around, which is part of the reason that my organization, ourtime.org, is focused on entrepreneurship and promoting young people who are creating jobs and trying to get more, as we call them, entrepreneurs by necessity To come rise out of this difficult recession.
And bless them if they can do it. We'll look at how much of an answer that can and might not be. Andrew Sum, it's not just jobs. It's other decisions and other sort of traditional life points that don't necessarily show up when we traditionally expected them when the jobs aren't there. When you leave home, when you get out of home, when you get married, all this is showing up from the census as well, isn't it, Andy?
Yes, it is, Tom. It's showing up in many, many ways. On the one hand, we have a larger fraction of young adults under 30
Matthew was talking about
are ending up staying at home, living with mom, dad, and other relatives. It's a 40-year high. And again, what you find is it matches the other data. It's more prevalent among men than among women. It's more prevalent among men without, by the way, college degrees, again, than those with college degrees. But you also have a growing share of young college grads who have to come home in order to be able to pay off their student debts.
And they're not getting married.
And what you do find is you're not forming independent households. So that hurts the housing market.
Mm-hmm.
They're not getting married. Marriage rates have declined. At the same time, which is even more troublesome, is that the fertility rate of young women has not come down that much. So as a result, we've got a record share of all births to young women taking place out of wedlock, which is going to place a tremendous difficulty on that next generation to be able to make it through on their own. So all these things are intertwined because we find that the likelihood that a young man and a young woman form their own household, the likelihood a young man gets married, a young woman gets married, is based on, no surprise, on unemployment earnings.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about a rising generation of young Americans staring at tough times. We're looking at the impact and how they are responding. Joining us today from Washington, Matthew Siegel, president, co-founder of Our Time. It's been called the AARP for the under 30 generation. Andrew Sum is with me in the studio, professor of economics, director of the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University. And there's a lot to study there right now. It's studying a lot of young people right back. The reality shows up in all the numbers. A few of those millions of young Americans on the streets in the last few days, Occupy Wall Street in New York, some in Boston as well. On Sunday, 23-year-old Kylie Ford spoke with my colleague, WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tonis, about why she joined demonstrations outside the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston.
I've been unemployed for 2 years now, and this is the first time I feel like people are really coming together and talking about the fact that we have, you know, widespread unemployment or underemployment.
Yeah, no kidding. And here's a 19-year-old New Jersey resident, Alex, joined the same demonstrations, but in New York. A YouTube video here, he explains what brought him out.
Well, me being 19, I was looking forward to going to college after high school, but I actually went for a semester, but I had to drop out due to the fact that my car broke down and I didn't have any more money for the car, and this greatly affected the whole refinance of, you know, of everything that happened. Greatly affected my mother, so she lost a lot of money in that, so I wasn't able to get a car. I still don't have a car, and it's very aggravating at the core of it all, it really is.
It's very aggravating, to say the least, if you're out there and can't get going. And now come the tags, you know, lost generation and all the rest, hearkening all the way back to what, nearly a century ago, after World War I, Ernest Hemingway said that Gertrude Stein was talking about the lost generation. She chastised one then, saying, "You have no respect for anything. You drink yourself to death." Hemingway didn't like it. He said, "The hell with her lost generation talk and all the dirty, easy labels." Well, what about you, 20-something today? How about your reality, the way it's being understood or not by the country? Kathleen in Iowa City, Iowa. Thanks for calling, Kathleen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just calling because I'm 25, and I had my undergraduate degree from the University of Iowa.
Great.
And I had to end up taking a waitressing job. I looked for journalism positions after I graduated with no luck, and I took the waitressing job, and it ended up not paying enough. I had a lot in student loans, and so I got an AmeriCorps position, luckily, on top of that. But now I'm back in graduate school because it was kind of the last-ditch effort, only option for me to really make enough money to pay back my student loans and to make enough money to provide for myself.
Kathleen, do you feel back in grad school like you're, you know, building the structure for a good future or hiding out from bad times? I, with respect, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's like both for me. I went back to build the structure, but I feel like school is a safe place right now for me. So it's kind of both.
Yeah, a safe place, and yet there are those may come with loans that keep mounting. We wish you luck with it, Kathleen. Let me get one more here. John in Boston. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask the professor if he noticed, I guess, a trend, a move into, I guess, sciences. I'm in graduate school now and transitioning from public policy to science, and a lot of my friends are moving, going back to med school and dental school, so I was wondering if he saw a trend, I guess, into math and science.
Andy Sum, if John and his friends can get beyond the waiter job, do you see a trend to science?
Well, there has been a push on to get more young people involved in what they call the STEM occupations, which would include, you know, engineering, science, technology,
math,
as well as, as well as that. But what you do find when you look at the labor market, Tom, in terms of early post-graduation outcomes, that young adults who did major in engineering and computer science-related occupations and in health occupations were the most successful in getting jobs related
to
the
most.
Yeah. And they also were among the best well-paid as well. So it does make good sense to choose your major very wisely in this area.
That's a pretty big incentive. But Matthew Siegel, it's no small thing if you're coming out, you know, with a BA in, you name it, philosophy or English, or to do that right turn and get into the sciences is not a small investment of time or money itself, Matt.
You're 100% right. And speaking as a graduate of Kenyon College in Ohio, which is a phenomenal school, but a liberal arts college, I can say with firsthand knowledge as a sociology major that my advice to other people my age might be, look, there are other emerging industries, whether it's nursing, whether it's the STEM fields, whether it's geriatric care, to look into, because those are all rising fields. But, you know, back to what Kathleen and some of the young people you just had on who spoke about Occupy Wall Street mentioned, I think it's very heartening for me to see our generation engaged in those protests. And one of the reasons for that is it gets to the heart of our completely broken political process. Young people are incredibly frustrated. My generation doesn't understand how a financial collapse can be caused by companies who possess so much undue clout and influence over the federal government, and meanwhile, the advocacy and representation of young people and the underemployed and the long-term unemployed in Congress, in our government, is negligible. And so I think this is not just a campaign against Wall Street. I think it's a campaign against special interests and a campaign of young people saying, look, you know, we support a system where a 15% capital gains tax to someone making millions and millions of dollars a year versus someone like Kathleen, who's working AmeriCorps, making $14,000 roughly a year and having to pay, in some cases, even greater taxes, is insane. And it's completely disproportionate, and it doesn't make sense. And I think you're going to see a whole populist movement surge around this. And I think you're going to see the president begin talking about it, too.
There's a prediction from 25-year-old Matthew Siegel. We'll see what unfolds there. A lot of arrests in New York over the weekend. It's a big country. A lot of young people out there. We'll see where their energies go. Omaha, Nebraska, Megan is calling. Hi, Megan. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My husband and I are in our late 20s, and our frustration, we're both luckily employed, but due to the economy, neither of us has gotten a substantial raise. I've been at my job for 5 years and barely gotten any raise, and we just have to continuously put off having children in our hopes and dreams for the future because we're trying to pay off all this debt that we've accumulated.
Debt is in school debt primarily, Megan, or other? Yeah.
Primarily school debt.
Yeah. So, yeah, there it is, and without those raises. So even with jobs, and you're not on the trend line. You're married, and you've got kids still in your 20s. But Andy, you know, here's a reality of no raises. What about the lasting impact here? They're trying to build a family. Others haven't even climbed to that point yet. There's a lot of talk about, you know, scarring for life, and some people are resistant to that, saying, come on, don't write us off. But what about the impact of years of no raises or no job at all?
Well, Tom, if you look back at the question about young families, these are, you know, families headed by a person under 30. What we have shown is that basically over the last decade, the average young family saw their income fall by about $8,000 or 20%. That's on average. And in fact, what we've shown, which is so disappointing that I even hate to bring it up, but the fact is that we estimate that the average income right in the middle of a young family today is equal to what it was in 1959. In 1959. When you adjust it for inflation, that's how much it's fallen.
Leaving out all those decades of sweat and effort and what was understood as growth.
Yes. We had, but to put this in perspective, if you look at what we used to call the golden era of the American economy, from the very end of World War II to 1973, during that time period, we showed that the average young family doubled their real income. Doubled, Tom, in 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're still below where we were in 1973. And in fact, today, what I'm saying is based on last year's income, we're back to where we were in 1959.
Well, what does that mean for this generation? We've got people online writing, you know, the way to succeed in this generation is to change your expectations. Don't be so consumerist. Don't be so materialistic. That's the only way it's going to work. What do you say?
Well, I think what we need to do is recognize that, by the way, there are, Tom, a group of young families that are doing better than ever before in American society. We tried to show if you're in the top 10. Yes. If you're in the top 10, that group is doing very well. They're making more than their parents did, making more than at any other time.
Top 10%. Well, but at least degree, it's not one, but okay.
But the degree of inequality here, Tom, is really grown substantially among young families.
Yeah.
So the person in the middle is struggling to get by. The people in the bottom have lost a lot of ground. So we also, around this kind of declining average, have this widening degree of inequality. Just as last thing related to the last call.
This doesn't sound sustainable, Andy.
No, it's not. But I mean, that's what I like to see what Matthew would say, because I've argued for years that we need an AARP for young people.
Mm-hmm. And
I
here
used
it is.
To berate my class. This is the time to do this now, because young people have been left behind. And the only way they're going to be paid attention to is when they do get paid, is when they do organize. And the sad thing about this, Tom, but it's related to it, is that, again, this recent paper we did, I tried to show that the gap in voting between young adults and middle and older adults is wider today than it's been in the last 30 years. So that the reason why the older get paid attention to is they vote and they organize themselves and the AARPs to respond to Congress. Young people have got to be involved politically and economically to have their case made to the Congress and the president both, by the way, who I feel have both let them down.
Matthew Siegel, you know, we see a very big income gap and wealth gap in the whole society. What about in your age cohort? Does that handicap them working together to say, let's improve things here? Or is there enough solidarity?
Well, it's a political
distraction. Isn't it kind of elemental? It's an economic reality.
People are so consumed by trying to get by trying to pay rent, by trying to pay off their debt, by trying to pay for groceries, that all of a sudden political engagement in and civic participation feels like a luxury. Now, the dangerous side of that is, of course, exactly what Dr. Sum noted, which is the fact that we're outvoted 2-1 by seniors demonstrates that policy consideration is much greater in their favor and in their attention. And this isn't a zero-sum game, too. I mean, look, seniors are our parents and grandparents. We want them to obviously retire in prosperity. We know they've lost their pensions in some cases, which is awful. And we also know that if they're broke, we're going to have to pay for them, too. So, I mean, we live in an interdependent society here. But at the same time, so few – I mean, look at the average age of a member of Congress. It's 59 years old. A senator is 63. Some of these people serving in Washington are completely out of touch with social media. There was just an AP study last week that talked about how members of Congress are not even using Twitter and Facebook to communicate. The communication divide is so completely stark between people serving and leading our country and the young people who are trying to communicate and get involved.
Matthew, what do you think about this idea of a scarred generation, a lost generation, a generation that carries its, you know, its late entry into a robust economic life, deep into its life? Do you fear that for the generation you're looking to represent?
Well, our generation's been labeled a lot of things. I mean, we've been called the next greatest generation.
Yes,
we've been called the echo boomers. We've been called pretty much everything. So I'm somewhat immune to labels, and I think my generation despises labels, which is why 4 out of 10 young people don't even identify with a political party anymore. I think the bigger issue is rather than just focusing on the pain young people are dealing with, which I think already we've given considerable attention to, in this program, let's look at what the labor market is missing. The labor market is missing the most highly educated generation in history, the most racially and socially tolerant generation in history, a generation that has more technological and social media savvy than any other generation before. If I'm an employer, I want those skills. And if I'm a country who's trying to be the forefront of innovation in the world, I want those skills too. Sadly, we're not putting them to use because we have broken priorities in this country.
There's an advocate for a generation, and we hear it. The best, the most, Caleb in Prattville, Alabama. Caleb, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. My name's Caleb. I'm actually in the construction industry. I do sheetrock. I hang and finish it.
Yeah, that's terrific. And, how old are you, Caleb?
I'm 25.
Okay. What do you see out there?
First off, a couple of different things. It's been so hard for me to keep work, even part-time doing construction, that I've had to get a second job, and I work with UPS in the evenings during the weeknight.
Yep.
And even that's been hard to keep my bills paid. But, you know, I just wanted to comment on all the college stuff. You know, I've been wanting to get into college myself, but with how expensive it is these days and my current situation, you know, I don't have parents to stay here in Alabama. I'm all here by myself.
What about, are you waiting for the housing market, or where do you see hope on the horizon, Caleb? What are you looking to?
Honestly, I'm looking to see the effects of this immigration bill because I've seen a lot of negative things happening out here in the housing market with not just, you know, people being treated unfair with wages and pricing and whatnot, but... Mm-hmm. You know, with the immigration law, I think it's going to get rid of a lot of problems we're having. You know, some of these subdivisions, these immigrants are actually defecating on the jobs and sleeping on the jobs. You know, it's not a way for them to live.
This is very, very tough immigration law. Alabama implemented it. The courts supported it last week. And you're hoping maybe that filters through for more construction work available to you, Caleb.
Well, not just that, just for the better... living qualities for these immigrants. You know, they shouldn't be living this way, you know, and it's wrong for some of these builders and some of the people out here that you know, actually support paying them these cheap labors and not caring about their actions, you know.
Caleb, I appreciate your call, and I wish you the best of luck there in Prattville. Andy Sum, what about how immigrants factor into the job prospects for young Americans?
Well, the answer to that is one that always gets controversial because basically my own research has shown that particularly undocumented immigration has hurt young people, particularly teenagers and young African American and young Latinos born in the United States. Mm. So it has been a factor. It is not the most important factor, but it has been a negative factor that I think gets missed in this debate. But the big thing about the last caller, though— mm-hmm. is that, you know, again, if you take a look at why young people have been hurt a lot, the construction industry has not only reduced employment, but like he reported, we've got this massive amount of underemployment among these construction workers.
Yeah.
They're working, like two people came by,
right? Hours.
Or they're just working 2 or 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the president had proposed the American Jobs Act, okay, as among that would be this infrastructure spending
pass
that would help
this
with,
bill.
Pass this bill, exactly. And besides, the best research on this, Tom, by individuals from the National Bureau of Economic Research has shown that the job creation effect of infrastructure spending is among the highest that we have implemented in the last few years. So the evidence is there. We should be doing it. We should not get this in congressional lack of will to take on this bill. This would really help young Americans a lot, more we could do.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a rising generation of young Americans staring at tough times, looking at the impact of that and how they are responding. Plenty of people hollering about current circumstances at the Occupy Wall Street rallies and marches recently. Here's their chant you can hear just from last week.
We
We are the 99%, they're saying there, and a few anyway, talking up big. Andrew Sum is with us, director of the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University. Matthew Siegel, president and founder of Our Time. It's an advocacy group out of Washington for the young, not AARP, but for those under 30. And lots of reaction online here. Ashley says you just can't win if you're in your 20s these days. Here Sam writes, I'm a 23-year-old newly minted college graduate. After graduating, I've moved back home to work the same summer job I've had the past 7 years. This fall, I've kept myself busy with two part-time jobs, some adult continuing ed classes, working out a lot. I don't really know what I'm going to do. I'm earning good money to enable me to pay down a chunk of my substantial student loans. The hard part is that although my parents have let me come back home, they'd make me pay rent, by the way. They both suffered economic setbacks themselves that have hurt the household financially. I may wind up contributing significantly to the family budget to keep us ahead of the mortgage. Throw in the social stigma of being in your early 20s and living with your parents, and it's not an easy row to hoe. And wow, can we hear that loud and clear? Very clear from Sam. Here John writes, as a 28-year-old who recently earned a PhD and took a good job in agricultural science, I think the quote, lost generation, took the do what makes you happy mantra a little too far. A few of my peers spent their late teens and 20s doing what felt good to them and not strategically positioning themselves to adapt to the changes around them. Doing what makes you happy doesn't adapt to our cyclical economy, John writes. Continuous strategic positioning does. And John, we're glad you found yourself in a good place there. Joining us right now from Houston, Texas, is Patricia Snell Herzog. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the Rice University Department of Sociology and the Kinder Institute for Urban Research, a co-author of the book that's come out recently called Lost in Transition, The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood. Patricia, thank you very much for being with us today. Sorry we kept you waiting a little there.
That's okay. Thank you, Tom.
So you looked at value systems among the young, how they're like and unlike their parents and earlier generations. And I wonder what you found and how it sets them up for their intersection, sadly, with this tough economy.
Absolutely. Much of what has been discussed already is exactly what we found in our interviews with what we call this period of emerging adulthood, where, as you all have already been discussing, we're seeing an increase in the time that people spend in this period of transition between their youth and between having a more stable economic and family situation that we tend to think of as kind of the typical adulthood period. And so there's this emerging time that's lasting for a longer period where people are not settled. And basically what we discuss in the book is the stories that people share and the pain that that people sometimes feel from this transition. There, as the callers have mentioned, are a number of people who are just really struggling to get by and experiencing a great deal of fallout from the lack of job availability, the increased time spent in higher education, the delayed marriages, and so there are kind of these... To me, as we did this research, I often pictured a little plane trying to get off the ground constantly and sort of, you know, having to go back to the runway to try to build up enough speed to take off and really take flight.
Mm. Patricia, one of the headlines that came out of reporting on your work was that this is a generation that doesn't have a language of moral values, that they're kind of, you know, do what feels good, do what feels right. They've taken some sort of heat for that. Did that get translated the way you meant it? Is that what you found?
Basically, I think similar to what Matthew was discussing is that basically in the face of this large economic and political sort of depressing system that feels, I think, to a lot of emerging adults today, basically out of their control and just too huge and too complicated to try to change, we see people kind of retreating to themselves, their own personal networks, and basically kind of having a sense that what is good is just to try to take care of yourself and maybe a few people that you know. And so this kind of this rising individualism in the face, I think, of too complicated of a social structure for people to really know how to engage and even discuss.
I saw a response from Danielle Tomino at the Huffington Post saying to this notion that this is a who am I to judge generation.
Exactly.
Awareness. But she's saying, look, young people today, they see all kinds of circumstances, and yes, it makes them less judgmental, but it doesn't make them morally illiterate. She wrote, they see themselves surrounded by a Venus flytrap of toxic judgmentalism that older adults feed. Meanwhile, young adults see this kind of morality failing them. They see judgment trumping cooperation, resulting economic instability. No wonder they're searching for a better way forward. Maybe it's flexibility to try and deal with the times they're in, Patricia.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely think that is what is happening, is people are seeking to be very flexible. And I don't think it's so much an illiteracy as it is hyper-literacy, in the sense that people are, emerging adults today have an enormous amount of information at their fingertips, are aware of all sorts of different perspectives on the economy, on the political system, on religious views, on morality, and simply are having a difficult time figuring out how to make sense of it all. So it's not so much that they're unaware or illiterate of the different perspectives. It's more so how to have your own perspective, how to move forward in a system that seems increasingly complex.
Matthew Siegel, what do you make of this kind of readiness to, again, it comes back to judging your generation, I guess, or tagging your generation, this idea of moral illiterates here as they're trying to juggle everything the economy and more is throwing at them these days. Do you worry about what kind of reputation this generation gets as it marches through tough times, Matthew, or are you confident?
I mean, I think there's always been a sense of kids these days pervading our generational vantage points in life. And every younger generation is kind of looked upon cynically as lazy or entitled. Look, I think that's a bunch of nonsense, and we've never really cared to focus or wage that battle. I think what's most insidious about what Patricia was just saying is the fact that this generation, because they're becoming more inward focused to take care of themselves, and I know so many people my age who've gone into fields like farming and agriculture because they just think, look, I'm going to have to be self-sufficient and provide for myself, rather than going into the more philosophically pleasing fields, in some cases in academia, which is becoming less and less realistic for my generation. What you're seeing is kind of, you know, since I'm on the panel with two other professors, I'll reference Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You have young people who are worried about feeding and sheltering and providing for themselves on the most basic level, that when it comes time for self-actualization or realization, which is political engagement, there's a limited time. And when there is, what's so insidious about the whole process is they view it as completely broken. It's representing the 1% as opposed to the 99%, as the protesters mentioned. And, you know, that's why you're seeing a completely different moral compass arise for my generation in the way we view politics, whether it's serving us in a functional or dysfunctional way, the way we look at moral values, the way we look at community. But I do think what's important to recognize is that my generation, from what I've been able to tell through some research, but mostly through anecdotal evidence, is that we're incredibly interdependent. And we do not view the world as focused on simply a zero-sum game of one generation succeeding and others failing. Mm. I think this is truly about us all helping each other through a rough time, and if we can restore that interdependence in our political system, we'll certainly do a lot better as a country.
I should say Patricia's probably very happy for the promotion, but at 33 years old, she's a postdoc fellow, not a professor yet, so she's got her job challenge.
Sorry
as well. I'm sure it'll go great. Let's
absolutely.
Go.
Absolutely, and if I could just respond to that too, that I mean, we specifically push back on the kids these day approach in mm-hmm. our book, and that we are telling these stories not to point the finger at the emerging adults, and in fact are raising this issue as problems that people of my generation and older really need to be the forefront of dealing with, that it's not fair to sort of blame the victims of these kind of structural brokenness. And essentially, and even I very much respect, Matthew, what you're doing and getting people of this generation involved to create change. But what we are saying is, in addition to that, we also need to look at our existing systems, you know, our families, our school systems, and what adults can do to change the way this society is raising emerging adults and preparing people for the times that are here.
Let me go to a caller. Nicole is calling from Boston. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's up?
So I'm calling from Boston. I've been occupied Boston since day one.
Oh, you're one of the people in the streets in Boston outside the Federal Reserve over this weekend?
Oh, yes, I am.
Okay. Why? And what do you see? And why are you there?
Well, I'm there because personally, my experience as a young adult in this world has been that there are no opportunities for me. I can barely afford school. I'm back in school after a 2-year break because I couldn't afford it. I haven't found stable housing. I just got into public housing. I couldn't afford a regular apartment because they're so high, and based on minimum wage, I just can't afford it. This is a time of no opportunities for our young people, and you can see lots of college kids and lots of young people who are here occupying with us because we don't feel like we have a chance in this world. We don't feel like we're being heard, that our needs are being met.
So what would you like to see happen? You're now there you are. You're in the streets. What would you like to see happen, Nicole?
Well, right now, I just want to see that people are listening and want to be heard. We don't have demands yet. I don't know if we're going to get demands as a group. But individually, I just want a chance in this world. And I know a lot of other people do. I want a chance to have education. I want a chance to actually have a place to live and food in the future.
Hey,
it's really as simple as that.
Nicole, we wish you all that, and we wish you more beyond that. And I appreciate your call right there. Occupy Boston calling in right there. Let's go to caller Chris in Iowa City, Iowa. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in because I'm kind of confused and maybe a little bit ashamed of, I guess it's my generation. I'm 29 right now.
Yep.
And I dropped out of high school when I was 17, 18 years old and lived my life, did things I wanted to do. But then around 22, I decided, oh, no, I need to do something. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to survive on this.
Right.
So I went back to school. Around 23 or so, and got my degree when I was 26 in software engineering. And I'm doing really rather well. I'm just wondering if the people of my generation or a little bit younger are actually having a plan and finding if they are pursuing something that's going to be sustainable for them.
So you're saying you're ashamed because they're not being more, I don't know, clever or strategic in figuring out a career plan, Chris?
They're not adapting to our current society, our current financial needs, our current economical needs, our current society. They're just doing something that they want to do and hoping that it sticks. It's similar to that adage of throwing crap at a wall.
Chris, I'm glad it's worked out for you. Let me pick it up with Andy Sum. What about this critique? You know, Chris is 29, and he says, well, you know, maybe if you just thought more carefully about it, set your compass more realistically or something, you know, you'd be fine. He's fine.
Well, I think that there are a number of findings that suggest that individuals who do try to put together a plan and a path have serious goals that they try to follow, do better. There's evidence on it that's clear. But there is no evidence, Tom, that the number of young people who are failing to make these plans has grown to any substantial degree over time. That basically, I still make the argument that it's really a macroeconomic argument that underlies the dilemma of these young people. It's not a generational shift. It's a generational shift in the economy where we've neglected young adults and young workers.
And you've got other longer-term implications, I guess.
And we do, Tom, because, again, if you take a look at, besides these declining incomes we were talking about, if you look at young families, what do we find? 70% of them have no property income from savings, from interest, from rents, none during the year. Top 10% gets 95% of it.
Even in the young?
Even among the young.
Wow.
Among the wealth, among young families, half of the young families in the bottom 50% have zero wealth. Zero wealth.
That means no savings or
no wealth. No financial.
Nothing that they own of wealth.
Homes,
just
anything.
Sort of getting
no
by.
Wealth. Zero value wealth.
Wow.
Okay. And again, you get about 90% goes to the top 10. And you also have declining home ownership among young adults. It's been down, fell the most over the last decade. Families with kids are down by the lowest point that we could find in the last 50 years. So it's not just incomes, it's wealth, it's home ownership, it's assets, it's everything. But here's what we need, Tom, just very quickly on this. Mm-hmm. I would suggest to Matthew, I said, why don't we call this AAYP, what I said 10 years ago, American Association of Young People.
Yeah.
Okay. But here's what we need. They should organize around the American Dream Act. And they should demand all those things I was talking about the infrastructure spending, creating jobs for young people, young adults, going beyond the AmeriCorps. We need many more things beyond AmeriCorps. What we should do is have this, Tom. There's a tax credit to employers. If you hire a new high school grad
mm-hmm.
or a new college grad, mm-hmm. okay, we will give you 30% of their wages back for the first $25,000 for the first year of their job. In other words, all tax credits go only to those employers that hire new workers. And we're going to put young people at the top of our list.
If we don't take those kind of steps, what happens?
We're going to be in this dilemma for the next 4 or 5 years, because without a strong stimulus, with jobs generated directly at the young, it's going to be a longer and longer time for the young to get back. We need a massive jobs creation effort for young people, private sector, public sector, and Matthew, with your entrepreneurship on top of it, they should be backed as well.
But Matthew, do you see that coming? Our time is short. I apologize, Andy, but Matthew, do you see that coming?
100%. I mean,
you
what
do?
I really would like to see do I see that coming from our Congress and
yes.
political system?
Yes.
No. Do I agree with everything Dr. Sum just said? Yes. What I would like to see come from these Occupy Wall Street protests are actual demands. I know they have not formed demands yet, and they're obviously protesting their frustration about the 99% not being represented. But look, we need, as Gordon Brown, the former prime minister of the UK, said, a Marshall or a WPA plan of a youth civilian corps to a huge degree in this country. Young people want to serve. Expanding AmeriCorps in city years is a no-brainer, but let's do workforce training. Let's make sure that we look at each growing field, green jobs, clean energy positions. We train people for that. I mean, there's lots of smart demands that these people and people in my generation can certainly get behind, and we need to.
Patricia, if the opportunity is there, Patricia, we just got 10 seconds. Will this generation pick up the harness if the opportunity is there?
I think we need more than just this generation doing something. I think that we really need to look at what our broader social institutions can do to facilitate this group.
We'll keep right on looking. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.